This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
You know what? It really pays to understand what is rational behavior. Everyone assumes, oh, I'm the rational one and everyone else is irrational. Well, we're all kind of irrational almost all the time, and there's reasons for that, because our brain needs shortcuts occasionally so we could think faster and make decisions. But that means we sacrifice a little bit of rationality, and particularly this year where it's like everyone is arguing about everything. There's no teams. Rational thinking means you're an individual and you compile wisdom in your life. You use that wisdom and plus your knowledge, which are different, to make decisions. So I'm really happy to have Steven Pinker, one of my favorite writers, come on the podcast and talk about his new book, Rationality. Here we go. The Better Angels of Our Nature is one of my all-time favorite books, and it's such an important book that people need to read. If I wanted to, I could use that book in an argument at least once a day. Because it's such an important topic, the fact that in general, against what people think commonly, violence as a species has gone down, you know, century over after century. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about your book, Rationality, which I will talk about in the intro. But I love the quote by Jonathan Haidt. If you ever considered taking drugs to make yourself smarter, read Rationality instead.
Yes, that's a quote to die for.
Which is very interesting. Now, and I'll just summarize, not necessarily the argument of the book, and you could correct me, but you basically argue that we are a rational species, but sometimes we get lazy in our thinking. If I were to summarize it in one sentence, and like this past year, as you mentioned, we did all these amazing things. We developed vaccines for COVID in a few months, and yet half the country and the other half of the country had all this mindless arguing all day long, all the time on all social media, that you start to think people are really crazy. Facts don't matter. Rationality doesn't exist. And so I'm really torn. When I began this book, I was really torn on both sides, that yes, we're rational because we survived as a species. We got food, we got shelter, we lived. But on the whole, you just look at anybody's Twitter feed and you think, oh my God, people are completely insane and irrational almost all the time. Let's start from there. What do you think?
Yeah, not almost all the time, but when it comes to certain politicized issues, they are. Particular issues can become badges of identity for political tribes or coalitions. Also, there are certain zones in which we fall back on our intuitions such as that living things contain some kind of essence that gives them their form and powers, and that makes us receptive to homeopathy, to all kinds of quack cures, crystal healing power, makes people reject vaccines, which seem like introducing some adulterant or germ into your body. We unlearn some of these primitive intuitions if we vest some kind of trust in the scientific establishment. But if people don't vest trust in the scientific establishment, they'll fall back on these intuitions, or they'll listen to other experts with the same air of confidence, but without the goods behind them.
So, well, let me ask you this, and this is related to the book. But where's the line where you should be a skeptic versus, okay, this is established science and we must believe it? And I think specifically the example, Igor Semmelweis in the, I think it was the 1850s, basically, without going into the whole story, just figured out that washing your hands will not convey diseases. And, you know, he discovered germ theory. And most people at the time, even scientists and doctors, did not believe him. And he ended up in an insane asylum for a while. So he was rational. Most people were not rational, particularly when confronted with something new. And it seems like that's the way of humans.
Well, it's, we have no one has a pipeline to the truth. And our natural state is ignorance about everything. We ideally have institutions that have built in checks and balances and demands for empirical testing, so that the institution as a whole will over time kind of wander its way into true beliefs and discard the false ones. But only to the extent that that community, the community of scientists or journalists or government officials or anyone, agrees to abide by these rules, to say no one can impose their beliefs by force, no one has a pipeline to the truth, no one's an oracle, no one is a deity, we're all fallible, we've got to provide the goods. If you believe something, you got to be able to explain why you believe it. You've got to be able to challenge someone who has a claim to the truth and get that person to show why we should believe them. If you've got a system like that, then there's no guarantee that it'll find the truth, and sometimes it won't. But that's our only method for finding the truth. Given that none of us has divine inspiration, none of us can listen to an oracle, that's our only choice.
So you define rational as using knowledge to obtain a goal. The knowledge could come from many different sources. It might be incorrect knowledge. We have to just sort of define knowledge, but it's rational to use the knowledge that you have. People, and you're saying people could be irrational if they're not using this knowledge to do certain things. You know, for instance, I had COVID recently, and everyone said, why didn't you get a vaccine? Using their models of vaccine taking, they thought, oh, I must be, you know, a racist if I didn't use a vaccine, or I must be some, you know, right wing this or right wing that. But the reality was, I was just lazy. I kept scheduling it and skipping the appointment, and then I got COVID. And okay. People would rather believe that there was some devious reason why I didn't get vaccinated. And because I think people think that others are rational, that in general, people are making big rational decisions, but we're usually not. We're usually, as you say, we're using kind of lazy thinking or lazy tools for deciding things.
Well, it's true that a lot of irrationality comes from falling back on your gut feelings, flying by the seat of your pants, going for the first response that occurs to you, and a lot of the demonstrations of predictably irrational thinking come from people not being smart enough to know the correct answer. When, as soon as you explain to them, they say, you know, they slap themselves on the forehead and they said, oh yeah, of course, what was I thinking? The problem was they weren't thinking, and that our gut feelings often lead us into bad conclusions. It's also behind the philosophy of governance, sometimes called nudge, promoted by
Richard Thaler.
Richard Thaler and my colleague Cass Sunstein, the idea that people very often fall back on, they just slip into a groove, they don't think twice. And so if you set up the environment so that the lazy option happens to be the rational option, you get a lot more rationality.
But it seems like there are a lot more reasons, even though you argue correctly, I feel, that being rational will improve your life in general. It seems like there are a lot more reasons to be irrational than to be rational. For instance, the community I live in might believe something as a community, and so it's easier for me to survive in that community if I just choose to be irrational and believe along with them. And this could happen at every level of society. So in general, right now, how rational are we? Like, what's your take?
Well, the thing is that rationality is always a means to an end. And the end, you might use your rational faculties to pursue something that you can't really rationally defend. So for example, if it's just to earn brownie points within your social clique, then indeed, if the people you hang out with believe a lot of false things, and if they're going to attack you if you speak the truth, then there's a limited sense in which it's rational to say things that are false, because no one wants to be an outcast. We all want to be accepted by our social group. That we can then ask the question, well, is your social group rational? And that's where you get to the implicit rules of the game that you follow as a community, what you reward other people for, what you tend to promote. And ideally, since we all want to be accepted, but we also don't want to be deluded. We don't want to believe nonsense. We really do want to reduce unemployment. We want to reduce COVID. We want to increase GDP, we want to increase happiness, we want to increase knowledge. Given that, you know, at the end of the day, it's hard to argue against those things, we can say, well, gee, are the kind of rules for who's cool and who's not in your social group likely to lead to more correct beliefs, which is something that at the end of the day, we probably all want.
Yeah, and I would say probably most people want to be more rational. And yet, Why do you think that, particularly we saw this past year, but I bet you we see this every year, and I'm just focusing on this past year. But, you know, there's a kind of a cliche now that facts don't matter in arguments. And you point this out in the book, that people almost immediately start engaging in, you know, ad hominem arguments, or, you know, mistakes in causation versus correlation. And, you know, what, you know, do we really want to be rational people? Or, again, why do facts don't matter? Why is that a cliche right now?
Well, no one would say facts don't matter. They would disagree as to what the facts are. The question is, how do we make sure that our beliefs are facts, and that we don't mistakenly believe things that aren't facts?
Right, but if I argue with you something where I think it's fact-based, and you don't know, you might just start with the ad hominem arguments. I'm not saying you specifically, but that seems to be a general argument. And I'm not saying either. Like,
I mean, the problem is that people do want to win arguments, and winning arguments doesn't necessarily mean that that you'll end up with the correct beliefs. It might be the person who shouts loudest, who has the deepest voice, who has the most authoritative tone, who uses dirty tricks of debating, like attacking the person instead of the argument, or appealing to authority, or appealing to the bandwagon. Those are all ways of appearing to win arguments, but unless you've got kind of a forum in which you say, no, wait a sec, just because you're citing someone with a fancy schmancy degree doesn't mean that he's right, or just because a majority of people believe it, that doesn't mean that it's right. You've got to show the goods by, you know, what are the verifiable sources, what are the empirical tests. Unless the rules of the game are such that the person who wins the argument is the one who has the best argument, as opposed to the person who's got the best mansplainer, the deepest voice, the one who shuts everyone up, the one who the demagogue, then the winner of the argument may not be the one who's correct. So what we ought to do is make it so that our debate forums, our discussions, our op-ed pages, our classroom discussions, our everyday barroom discussions are steered toward what really are facts, as opposed to who has the loudest voice or who can attack the other person.
But maybe having as a goal winning arguments, and then using the knowledge at your disposal, like, if I have a louder voice, I'm going to win. These people are engaging in rational behavior. Like, you started off as an evolutionary psychologist, or you are an evolutionary psychologist, and it could be that the one who wins the most arguments rises up in the hierarchy of the tribe back in, you know, hunter-gatherer days.
Well,
so that could be rational behavior.
You don't even have to look back to hunter-gatherer days. We still have implicit dominance hierarchies. The thing is that what's rational for a local goal, a short-term goal, like being the alpha debater in your social circle or in your barroom clique, may not be rational if you step back and you say, well, geez, is that a rational thing to want? Yeah, you're really good at getting it, but at the end of the day, wouldn't we prefer that our beliefs are aligned with reality? And you could argue about what our goals should be, and where it may be rational to strive for a goal that is itself irrational. So you've got to apply rationality at multiple levels, namely, what are the best means to a particular end, and is that an end that you really want, or that you really ought to want?
So what's an example where your goals might be irrational?
Well, if the goal is just to win an argument, to shout down the people who disagree with you, that's a goal that is maybe rational for yourself, but it's irrational if you are deciding on what ought to count, what ought to be rewarded, what ought to be praised, what ought to be tolerated in a particular social group. So the social group itself can have goals that differ from the goals of the individuals. Just like in a democracy, the goal is maximum freedom and happiness and prosperity. Now, there may be individuals who have their own goal being to become a dictator, an autocrat, but that's just too bad. That is their goal, but the rest of us can get together and say, we're not going to indulge that goal. You might want it, but we're not going to let you have it, to the extent that we can prevent it.
So it seems like you could be rational at the micro level, and it gets more and more macro.
In science, for example, there's intense competition for grants, for tenured positions, for prestige, and in a narrow sense, it's rational to try to gain fame and glory and riches and prizes. for that individual, but it's not rational for everyone else to let that person get away with it. It's rational for everyone else to set up the rules of scientific argumentation so that the person whose theory is right gets the prestige, not just the person who tries, you know, dirty tricks, who suppresses criticism, who fakes his data. There are all kinds of ways that it might be kind of narrowly rational to attain one goal, namely fame and fortune, but irrational if the system lets people get away with it.
So in the book, you describe rationality, and you almost start with first principles. Like, here's what, you know, logic and critical reasoning is all about. Here are the cognitive biases that we have to fight against. Let's just talk a little bit about cognitive biases for a second. So Daniel Kahneman has described all these almost shortcuts in our thinking that could create irrational behavior. And you give many examples in the book. And Kahneman insists there's no way around these cognitive biases, that humans fundamentally, it's like a primal thing. We have these cognitive biases. Where does that fall on the side of humans are basically rational versus irrational?
Well, Daniel Kahneman, the brilliant psychologist, Nobel Prize winner, it tends to be something of a pessimist when it comes to overcoming human biases. He does believe that it's possible because he posits that there are two systems of thinking. He calls them, not very colorfully, System 1 and System 2, where System 1 is kind of gut feelings, first responses, instincts. System 2 is thinking twice, deliberating, pondering. And so he does argue that System 2 can't override System 1, but it's got its work cut out for it because System 1 is what comes to us naturally and easily. And there are, you know, I think we must be aware of the kinds of biases and shortcuts that Kahneman and his late collaborator Amos Tversky call to our attention. But there are ways of making people more rational. And we know that people have to be rational at some level, because otherwise, you know, unless we think that Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky are a superior breed of humans, they're just like us. So they have what we have. And we can teach people why something is a fallacy, and they nod and they say, oh yeah, you're right, that doesn't make any sense. So they've got a rational side that can do that. And there was some human being who laid down the rules of logic and the laws of probability. So it's not like it's beyond us. And it's not just that there's a tiny fraction of super geniuses and they're the only ones who can grasp these concepts. You can't explain them. And there are ways of presenting material that are more intuitive. And so that the kind of fallacies that people are, that fall into, they can also see their way around. You can present problems in a way that jibes with the way the human mind works, and then we don't become so stupid.
Give me an example of that. How can we present a problem so that we rationally look at it?
You know, a notorious failure of decision making comes from interpreting the results of medical tests, or for that matter, any other kind of iffy information. Like, you take a test and there's a certain false positive rate, there's a certain false negative rate. As you take a COVID test and it might say you're free and you might actually have the disease, it might say you have the disease but actually you're healthy. So there are errors in both directions. How do you, given that you've tested positive, how do you assess your own chances? Or an x-ray or scan for breast cancer, or a PSA test for prostate cancer. They're all iffy, and how do you make sense of them, as we do, because we don't have a pipeline to the truth? Well, people are kind of notorious for not taking into account the base rate. That is, if the disease is really, really rare, even if you get a positive result, if the disease is just rare in the population, probably your result is a false positive, just by the, as we say, the law of averages. That's a fact that people have, that just doesn't penetrate, even with doctors. So for example, if disease prevalence is say 0.1%, and even if the test is pretty sensitive, then a positive result probably means you don't have the disease, or at most, you know, 50-50. People get it wrong when you present the data as the base rate for the disease is 0.1%, the false positive rate is 0.1, the false negative rate, et cetera. You give them people those numbers with decimal fractions between 0 and 1, and they come to the wrong conclusion. If you convert it now to something much more concrete, you say there are 1,000 people in the population. One of them has breast cancer. Of every 100 people who get a positive test result, 10 of them don't have the disease. So you make it really concrete. You talk about actual bodies that people can visualize in their mind's eye. Well, all of a sudden they get the answer right. And the people who formerly were almost all wrong, suddenly with a switch of format, get it right. It's even better if you present it as a diagram. So the trick is to take advantage of the formats in which the mind naturally processes information. And that is not typically numbers, fractions, decimals. You have to have a lot of experience with them for them to be intuitive. On the other hand, we are visual creatures. We encounter experiences in life. We take lessons from what happens to us and what doesn't happen to us. And if you present the information in terms of, one out of 1,000 people instead of 0.1%, then it becomes much more intuitive.
So in the book, you describe rationality, I think, and again, you build up from very numbers-oriented, like, here's the actual probability of this event or decision. You explain the rules of logic, cognitive biases, and you know what happens there, and illusions, and so on. And then it gets a little bit more, there's a lot more uncertainty. So when it comes to political issues, ethical issues, economic issues, and so on. In general, through all of these, how can we become more rational? And like, I'll give an example of the logic one. You give some puzzles in one of the first few chapters where, is it more likely that someone, you know, Anne is a feminist, or is it likely that Anne is a feminist and a nurse? And people will say feminist and a nurse, even though that's a subset of all the people who are feminists, so it can't be more probable.
It's like saying that you have a greater probability of drawing a red queen from a deck of cards than a queen.
Same
fallacy. And people make it when the stereotype is vivid enough. If you describe Anne as a social justice warrior, and she marches in Black Lives Matter, and she supports Bernie Sanders, then you say, what are the chances that she's a nurse? What are the chances that she's a feminist nurse? They say it's more likely that she's a feminist nurse. That's the so-called conjunction fallacy. Yeah.
Right. So why are people, given that that's so totally irrational, why do people do that? And let's start with there, and then from there, let's build up and figure out how to be more rational.
Yeah, so people, this again is a discovery due to Tversky and Kahneman. They call it the representativeness heuristic, but a better way of thinking about it is thinking in stereotypes. Namely, she fits the stereotype of a feminist, and so feminist bank teller is compelling. She doesn't fit the stereotype of a bank teller, and we go with the stereotypes, not with the frequencies. By the way, this is another case in which if you present it as what is the chances that Anne is a feminist bank teller? And you might think, well, what do you mean, what are the chances? Either she is or she isn't. What does it mean? What does it even mean to say there's a 0.3 probability that she's a feminist bank teller? She is what she is. On the other hand, if you say, well, imagine 100 women like Anne, 100 women who meet the description. How many of them are bank tellers? How many of them are feminist bank tellers? Well, now people tend to get the right answer. It's suddenly they're no longer as stupid as they seemed. And it's another example of how presenting information concretely in ways that we can visualize can sometimes make people a bit more rational than if you give them abstract numbers. Even though it's abstract numbers that we deal with in school, we deal with in many professions, but it's just not what we evolved to work with.
So that's the responsibility of the problem asker. So as a problem solver, how can one kind of train their mind and their mind and body to be more rational?
Well, part of it is you can convert problems into images, into concrete scenarios, just to do that translation yourself if the person posing the question wasn't considerate enough to have done it for you in the first place. But also if you're an educated person and if you're a well-read person, then all of these tools that are not second nature to us, that we didn't evolve with, but that the logicians and mathematicians over the centuries have devised, we can learn them the same way we learn to read, which is an unnatural skill. And one of the points of my book, Rationality, is to provide people with the basics of these tools of rationality that don't come naturally to us, but that really do help us become smarter, to think better. So it's not so terrible I think it would be a good thing if everyone was taught probability in elementary school, if everyone, including the what sounds complicated but isn't, namely Bayes' theorem. So kind of the how do you evaluate beliefs in the light of evidence. Some game theory, some logic, some probability theory, some statistical decision theory. These are all things that I think a educated person should have at their fingertips and should call on to supplement the rationality that we were born with.
Beyond that, even, because let's take political issues or economic issues or, life issues. Like, let's say, I'm thinking of moving from Illinois to Tennessee. I want to make a rational decision. How should people go about thinking about everyday problems instead of, problems where there's a concrete solution?
Yeah. I mean, stepping way back, I think one of the biggest boons to reason is a trait. It's almost a personality trait called active open-mindedness. That is, instead of always doubling down, digging in, looking for evidence that supports your beliefs, consider the possibility that you're wrong, listen to the other side, try to figure out, if I was wrong, how would I know? How would the world tell me? If the facts change, should I change my mind? That whole suite of personality traits can make you more rational. Literally, and we know that because if you give people tests of, say, predict the future, what's going to happen in the next 6 months, the ones who are open-minded have a way better track record, because the people who are closed-minded will glom onto a belief and hold it even if the world is telling them over and over again you're wrong. So you got to start with that mindset. Then for particular decisions, you give yourself some time. Don't go with your gut feeling, with your first response. I mean, this is hardly new wisdom, but although there is a trend, a fad to say, go with your gut, don't overthink things, but probably you're generally better off thinking them through. In the case of risky decisions, having a sense of both the probabilities and the outcomes. What do I stand to gain or lose if this happens, and what are the chances that this will happen? Weighing those up that's sometimes called rational choice theory or expected utility, and it's not a guarantee that you'll make the right decision, but it's a good thing to try to think through.
Like, how do we develop, let's say, adaptive open-mindedness? Like, that seems like a muscle one has to practice or exercise.
It is. It is kind of a bit of wisdom that the sages throughout the eras have advised us. Part of it is just be a virtuous person and try to think that way. But part of it is also, as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, a lot depends on the rules of the game, of the community that you're part of the clique. Do we humiliate people for being a flip-flopper? And say, yesterday you said this and today you say that? Or do we reward people for saying, the famous quote attributed to John Maynard Keynes, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? Now, probably, by the way, Keynes probably never said it, but but someone did. As with most quotes, yes. But it is a good rule to live by. But that means, it doesn't just mean cultivating that virtue in yourself. It means rewarding it in others. Like, hey, good for you. You changed your mind when the facts changed. You're a flip-flopper. Why should we believe you if you just change your mind?
What's something you feel incredibly strong about? Like, some common issue, it would be hard to change your mind because you've seen the facts, you've seen the science, and so on. Or there's no facts in science. It's just your belief.
Well, I'll give you something that I've certainly staked my name to. That is that progress is a real phenomenon. That is, if you measure things that are... that we count as good, beneficial, like peace, like knowledge, like prosperity, like happiness, they have increased over the long run.
Yeah, I mean, and this was a great example. You had great examples in both Enlightenment Now and The Better Angels of Our Nature. And those, you give certain metrics as showing progress, and then you're able to show how those metrics have increased. Stay tuned for part two, which came out today as well, where we continue our talk about what techniques can you use to actually specifically be more rational, and how do you know how rational you are? Listen to part two.